Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Listen, talk radio is primarily political. Let's start with that. However, I try to give you more than politics. I try to give you a versatile show, and many of you say, oh, Mike, we know where you stand politically. Tell us more stories about Teddy. Tell us. How much can I tell you about Teddy? So I'll tell you about Teddy. No, I don't have anything to tell you about Teddy. I'll tell you another story, just for the heck of it, since I need a breather myself. My head's spinning. Why? We had a mini family gathering over the last 3 days. Someone I love dearly came up, and you know how obsessed I am with food, right? I am like a starvation case compared to this individual who puts me to shame in terms of the obsession with food. We have been eating for 3 days straight. I've been giving food away to anyone I could find, bags of bagels, packages of smoked salmon. Chinese food was given away in trays. This is astounding. No one could believe the amounts of food that were ordered. I'm sick from it. I need to have my stomach pumped from the last. I mean, this weekend I'm going to basically spend in bed trying to purge the food we've been eating. I've never seen anything like this. You say, well, okay, what's so funny about that? Nothing. There's nothing funny about it. That's just the point. So what is this all about? The answer is, this is family. You get together over a meal. You break rice together. You argue for 3 days straight. What could be better? What could be better than to argue over the drop of a grain of rice? Nothing could be better than that. That's family life. You see, if you think that family life consists of life with father and everyone gets together and it's you hold hands and you pray to the Lord and yes, Father, I love you and yes, Mother, may I help you and yes, Son, you're wonderful and yes, Daughter, you're great. Well, you don't know what real life 101 is, because family life is strife life. Family life is strife life. And the faster you know that life is strife to begin with, the less trouble you're going to have with life. That's life 101. Anyone who tells you that you're supposed to have a smooth ride, life is not a bed of roses. Anyone who promises you that is sending you down the road of disappointment, frustration, and medication. The day you learn that life is strife, life is disagreement, life is arguing with people and coming to a conclusion without violence, then you're on the road to understanding what life really is. Life is struggle. That's all. It's as simple as that. So if this sounds like something you already heard, I can't help it. Sometimes the simplest things are the truest things. You understand that? Now let's get back to regular programming. How come you've tuned out of politics? How come you have tuned out of politics? Lou on WOR, you're next up. Go ahead, please.
Michael, I'm tuning out of politics because we are all being inundated by so much garbage from this administration on a daily basis that as a human being, you can only absorb so much of this crap. So I'm taking a step back, waiting for the election, and hopefully we're going to run this guy out on a rail in November.
So wait, so you're confirming what I suspect, which is you don't even want to hear what Obama does next because you wouldn't be shocked by it.
Not at all. I wouldn't be shocked by anything.
Okay, so you're saying I understand he's bad. I understand he's a devious guy who's out for as much power as he can get. They're corrupt. They're robbing the Treasury blind. What can I do about it? I have one chance. That's November. Until then, I don't even want to hear about it anymore. Is that basically what you're saying?
That's basically it, Michael. And as far as I can see, what this guy gets away with, he makes Al Capone blush in his grave, not turn over and do circles. He makes them blush.
I've never seen anything like this, and I've also never seen such a media cover-up like this. No. Never. Never. It's astounding. It's astounding.
These people, these journalists, they're an embarrassment, an absolute embarrassment. They're cheerleaders.
Yeah, no. The journalism schools were taken over 20 years ago by three different men. I knew all three of them. I didn't know them personally. These were all hardcore radicals on the order of Reverend Wright. They run the journalism schools in this country, and they handpick the stooges that are allowed to go through them and graduate so they can control them like puppets. So that's why we have a compliant press. But, Lou, having said what you said, that there's too much corruption, you don't want to hear any more about Obama's scandals, you know what he is, you know that he's basically trashed the White House and America, you know that he stabs us in the back at every turn, you know he laughs at us behind our back, you know all of this. What, then, would you tune into talk radio to hear till November?
Michael, you make my wife and I laugh, and you also, you know, you fill the airwaves with wisdom, whether it's quoting from the Bible, whether it's quoting from your personal life, whether it's the Italian guys that helped rescue you on the boat that time from the guy that was going to try to do something. I mean, it's one thing after the other, whether it's the other guy.
Oh, you remember that one little story when a guy got nasty and some Italian kid came over and threatened to beat him up for me?
Well, there were three guys. I think you said they were all from Brooklyn, and they approached.
Yeah, they were. I've never saw that guy again. I mean, we called each other, we emailed each other a few times. I never saw him again. He was a great guy. He said, he didn't even know me. I remember he came over. He said, "Hey, Mike, is this guy bothering you?" You should have seen the three of them run back into their sailboat, the smarty little liberals with their headbands.
Right, and I'll tell you, Michael, those are the guys. The wise man once said, "The world we grew up in is no longer here." That wise man is you, and those guys from Brooklyn, and my uncles that are no longer here. The colorful characters that I grew up with are no longer here. That's why I tune into you. You're my colorful uncle that I grew up with, Michael.
Well, Lou, I got to tell you, unfortunately, you make me a little nervous and sad when you say that. I know that's true. In many ways, I'm one of the last people standing from that generation, certainly in the media. You know, the time has gone by very fast, Lou. To me, I don't want to get maudlin right now, but 1994 is when I began in radio. I was already a man with three previous successful careers. I went into radio late in life. I never thought I would last this long, nor did I ever expect I'd still be here standing on Earth to begin with. And here I am standing strong as from the day I started, and I haven't really changed my politics. But when I see the media landscape and I realize that most of the other fellows, even on the conservative side, are like 20 years my junior, I realize that I'm in a very special position. You understand that, don't you?
I don't know what your listeners would do without you, Michael, to be honest. I mean, it's you're a breath of fresh air, your insight into things, your intellect, and I'm not just trying to butter you up. But
no, it's because I'm an older person who's lived a very full life so far. Unless you have a wife and children and a family and you have that, you really shouldn't even be in talk radio, to be frank with you. And I'm not knocking anyone in particular. Unless you have had children, you have no right talking about family values. Am I right or wrong about that?
Right about that, Michael. And by the way, we love your stories on Teddy, of course. We have three dogs of our own, and we love them.
Oh, this is great. Okay, my friend Lou, if you name it, you gain it. What's the book?
Trickle Down Poverty.
Okay, you get it anyway. It's very hard. The winner was Trickle Up Poverty. Now this is Trickle Down Tyranny, and I want everyone who bought the poverty book to buy the tyranny book.
Savage.
Talk radio, Michael Savage. 1-800-449-8255 is the phone number. I think I need a vacation. I'd like to go to a campground for about 3 weeks. Play some jazz for me. I'm running out of steam here. I'm thinking of buying a campground because I don't want to go to one where anybody is there, actually. Look, I'm a loner. What could I tell you? If I have to listen to somebody for 1 minute, I go berserk. No, let me talk about that for a minute. Turn off the music. I went on the internet today because it's August already. I had enough of the politics of another book coming out. I'm burned out. So I started to look in certain areas of Placer County, California, which are has some of the most gorgeous lakes in the world. Gold Lake and things like that. So there's campgrounds up there that are on Forest Service land that are on long-term leases that the owners have. They have like five cabins. You know, some of them are rather primitive. Beautiful log cabins that I dreamed about as a boy. No television, you know what I'm saying? So I said, well, why don't I buy one of those lodges with five cabins, you know what I'm saying? And invite nobody there, just be me and Teddy. Because I actually think at this phase of my life, I wouldn't be able to handle it. I don't think I could handle it anymore. Maybe when I was young, yes. But at this stage of my life, I don't think I could be alone in the woods anymore. I don't have a Thoreau thing in me. A lot of people go crazy, by the way, when they go back to nature. They don't tell you about that. Oh, yeah. It's a famous story. In the 60s, there was a couple. I forget who they were. They went back to nature. They were heroes of the liberals in the commie left, the peacenik back-to-earth movement. And they moved to Alaska to get away from it all, right? And they used to write articles. They lived 6 months in Alaska in the outback, and then 6 months they live in the Caribbean when it got cold. So, all right, they have it both ways. All right, it's their business. Eventually, the guy walked into a propeller blade of a plane. He couldn't take it anymore. Just him and his long-toothed wife, you know what I'm saying? And the mosquito. Him and the mosquito and the wife. He walked into the propeller of the plane that came to get him. This is the problem. You can't do the back-to-nature thing anymore. It's too late. Thoreau is dead. Sacramento, Tony, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Michael, greetings from all your fans born in 1981.
Hey, thank you.
Recently, I went on a hike way up in the hills there and found a crystal-clear, ice-cold lake, and I went swimming in it, and it was one of the most refreshing things I can remember in the past. I wondered if you were a swimmer. And if you
I am. I'm a very good swimmer. I'm a former lifeguard. I haven't saved anybody's life, but I'm a former lifeguard. I'm a very good swimmer to this day. And the question is what, Tony?
Do you take advantage lately of the ice-cold, beautiful mountain?
You know, you're raising a very interesting point. I've read that immersing yourself in ice-cold water, although it's shocking, is one of the most healthful things you can do. I have an aversion to cold water. I don't really like cold water, Tony. Maybe what I need right now is throw myself in San Francisco Bay. I don't mean off the Golden Gate Bridge. I'm saying pull my boat into a cove. It's 58 degrees, the water, though. That's the thing. It's cold.
No, go up to a lake up on Mount Lassen and take a dive.
What's the water temperature in a lake up there?
I don't know, but it was perfect. Probably a little bit warmer than 58 degrees.
Okay. Well, I remember there was an area in Alpine Meadows, California, that's a stunning. There's an area called Five Lakes. You probably don't know that area. In 1980, I was hiking up there a lot with family when the kids were young. I even was able to backpack one of my children on my back all the way to the top of the lake. You get up there in August, there's still snow on the ground, which to me is miraculously beautiful. And the lake, the ice has finally melted out in late August. The water is like ice water, you know what I mean, Tony? And at that time, Mrs. S. swam in that lake. I couldn't even put a toe in it. Some people have a capacity for cold water. I don't have it.
You should try again.
Yeah, you mean maybe it'll snap me out of my malaise?
It might do something for you.
Yeah, it could give me a heart attack altogether. Or either way, it's better off than what I have now. Oh, God, I shouldn't get... Thank you for the... No, you got to be careful. I don't believe in shocking the system. I have my own exercise regimen. It consists in watching 5 to 6 hours of television after... No. I bicycle every day. I really do. I don't mean... You see, this is... I'm going to talk about exercise. Am I at a break point here or what? Where am I? I'm fine. I could talk for 3 minutes. Good. You know, a lot of guys drop dead in their 30s way back when from excessive running. They would run and look at the watches, bingo, blowout. So I was a runner when I was in my 30s. I weighed, you know, I was thin, low cholesterol, runner. Till one day I was running up to a waterfall. Every day I'd run to a waterfall. And I heard an inner voice screaming at me, stop running, stop running, stop running, stop running. So I thought I went crazy. So I stopped running. Never ran again the rest of my life. My body was warning me to stop running. And then in that decade, there were a lot of very famous deaths of runners. Jim Fix, for example, was a very famous runner. He wrote for Runner's Magazine, and he dropped dead while running. So you say, well, what does that prove? I'm not saying it proves anything other than the body is not made for continuous stress of this kind, the kind of people put themselves through with exercise. So as time went on, I started to study different methods of what's considered to be exercise. And the Chinese have it right. The ancient Chinese had it exactly right, which is the moderate approach to it. No excessive pushing of the body. At least that's what I interpreted it to mean. I mean, maybe it's my own interpretation. So if I bicycle moderately, not until I'm in a sweat bath and looking at a watch. I'm not doing it to sweat. I'm doing it to get some balance in my body. Balance is one of the most important things you can get in your body. So bicycling is excellent for gaining balance alone, even if you just do it to keep your balance. I bicycle all my life, by the way. If I miss a day, I don't feel good. A couple of miles to town and back, go to look at people down in the mall, see what's going on, women, children, men, vendors. You know, it's like a touch of life. It's a real town. In the modern American suburb, the mall is actually our town, since there's no towns left to speak of. It's as good a town as any. So anyway, bicycle, look around, push around, get some, you know, yard time, go back to the prison of the computer and radio. But when it comes to pushing your body, I believe that many young men have it wrong, and they really push themselves too hard. They push and they push and they push and they run for a certain amount of time. They look good, don't get me wrong. They're thin, they're lean, they're in good shape. But I'm not so sure that that is so good to sustain for a very long period of time in your life. Moderate, moderate, moderate. And all you've got to do is talk to an orthopedic surgeon about it if you think I'm making this up. The joints will go from excessive pounding. The hips, the joints are going to be replaced early on from the running. So there are other less, what do they call it? There's a word, less impact kind of sports that you can practice. But it's the same with weightlifting. You don't have to crunch weights for 5 hours a day. I mean, unless you're a Navy SEAL or something like that, or an Army Ranger or one of those, of course you want to be as hard as a rock. But I'm talking about the average person who wants to keep reasonably fit after the age of a certain age. That's all. You don't have to overdo it. That has been my philosophy. And thus far, it's worked for me. That's all. That's all I'm saying. I think that everyone has to come to their own ideas about what's going to work for them, and it comes back to the jumping in a cold lake. Now, maybe that's good shock therapy when you're young and it wakes you up. It's certainly invigorating. But I think after a certain age, if you leap into an ice-cold lake, you run the risk of a shock that could be fatal to your system. Things change, the body changes, people change, and you have to change with your age. You have to change with the ages as well. Nothing significant in what I just said at all.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Yeah, remember that sound from my show back in the early days? The economy's so bad, how come the restaurants are so full? I don't understand that. If the economy's so bad, how come the restaurants are packed? The roads are full of new cars? How does this work? I don't know. What is there, like two societies that I'm living in? I'm going to ask you a question on the Savage Nation. Do you want me to reading from the Political Zoo, being sarcastic or satirizing politicians and media figures? Because most of you never heard of the book. Or you want me to do something else? It's open mic to Mike at the Savage Nation, 1-800-449-8255. Really, I'll work for you. We'll work for food. We'll work for you. We'll work for food. So to just show you one last one for the moment, I did both sides of the aisle, liberal and conservative, which virtually no one else could say they did back in those days. This is how I established my independent credentials. And in the Political Zoo, the satire of these various figures, I satirize Boxer Bush, Jimmy Carter, James Carville, Hugo Chavez, Dick Cheney, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, George Clooney, Katie Coran Couric, Maureen Dow, Dianne Feinstein, Newt Gingrich, Ruth Gator Ginsburg, Rudy Giuliani. Where is he, by the way? How come he hasn't thrown his glasses in the ring? Al Gore, Jesse Jackson, Kim Jong-il, John Kerry, Larry King, Rush Limbaugh, Bill Maher, John McCain, Bill O'Reilly. That's why he never forgave me. It's why I'm banned on Fox News. He has the worst temper in the entire media, according to people who know him. The meanest of all of them is O'Reilly. No humor whatsoever. I mean, they claim liberals have no humor. This guy has never forgiven me for a few things I said about him. All I do is call him a leprechaun. Big deal, Bill. Sheesh, Bill. All I said was lecherous leprechaunus. I mean, what was so bad about that, Bill? Bill O'Reilly was known as top mammal in the Fox News pundit cage, the American porcupine being a large terrestrial rodent well protected by its prickly exterior. Ooh. And his Latin binomial was lecherous leprechaunus. When challenged, it erects its quills, swings its stout tail, and threatens to release the barbed tips into challenger's skin. Known for its grunting or groaning delivery, the porcupine is active mainly at night and is found occasionally on televisions in the sagebrush plains of the West. Also, according to legal filings that were settled, the American porcupine will occasionally try to find cable station staff willing to play games like fetch the loofah as part of its bizarre mating ritual. So that's why you never see Michael Savage on, you know, that talk show. They bring up talk shows you never heard of. Never Michael. It doesn't matter anymore. I'm too far advanced in my career for it to matter. So you could see why the O'Reilly Factor runs the station. But until then, a word of warning to all you ladies out there in the Savage Nation, I wrote. If you phone O'Reilly's show during porcupine mating season, which lasts from about January to December, do your best to sound like Janet Reno, avoid the subjects of Greek food and cleansing devices, and above all, steer clear of the porcupine's biggest turn-on, namely himself. Oh! A porcupine in heat is a dangerous beast. If he loves you, you'll be able to count the ways. If he loves you, I haven't read this in years. If he loves you, you'll be able to count the ways. In fact, you'll be able to count them by the thousands while you pluck them the morning after. Oh, come on, Bill. Have a sense of humor. Don't be like Nancy Pelosi and Hillary Clinton. Nancy Pelosi was known as, let's see, leftist irrationalis. Nancy Pelosi, leftist irrationalis. With its large beak and small head, the distempered rainbow parakeet, the distempered rainbow parakeet caws with great frequency and volume, yet lacks mental capacity to emit anything original or intelligent. Fortunately, the bird has developed an adaptation that helps it to cope with this problem. The beak's large upper mandible is notched for its little bird foot to fit in. Decked with bright blue plumage, the female of the species mates for life usually with strong and crafty males, capable of building large nests and stashing a surplus of fruits and nuts therein. Not only does this preserve the pair from want, but also frees the female to spend nearly all of its waking hours bobbing through the jungle, screeching at any animals not of its flock, and pretending to care about those that have no nests and food at all. Although its original habitat was Maryland, the breed has since migrated to the San Francisco Bay Area, where it aggressively climbed the political pecking order. Today it can be found both in California and Washington, D.C., chirping away mindlessly in either environ. Curiously, aside from its lower-than-average intelligence, the parakeet suffers from one prominent congenital disability. It is only capable of flapping about in circles, primarily because it is born with only a left wing. Nobody has ever written anything better than this. Political satire in our time. Sean Penn, pesky apologista. Native to the left coast, the big-beaked toucan is a colorful and perpetually ill-tempered bird of paradise, born and bred in the protected environs of Hollywood. But unlike most toucans, this one is strangely compelled to migrate to war zones and disaster areas. While adverse to the glare of flashbulbs, hence the bird's notoriety for striking out at photographers, the big-beaked toucan can deftly mimic the dove but in front of television news cameras. This particular breed of toucan gets its name from its decidedly large beak, perfect for tracking down bad scripts and sticking that giant proboscis where it doesn't belong. Not bad. Sean Penn, the toucan tough guy, has a long history of appearances in cinema. It's pretty good. I'm not going to read it all to you. Yes or no? Keep it up or not? What would you like to hear? Houston, Texas. Jared, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Dr. Savage, who do you like?
Well, they're all, none of them are living.
Oh, gosh. I mean, if you do the zoo, and you had to identify...
Wait a minute. See, this is an interesting question. Must I like any of the Republican candidates? Is it a requirement?
No. But there's got to be someone...
So, in other words, I'm a commentator. Remember that. I'm only a commentator. And my job is to be a pain in the you-know-what for the political class. It doesn't matter what side of the aisle they're on. That's my job. Now, the truth is 80% of the criminals are Democrats. 20% of them are Republicans, and they're all bad in that regard. But that doesn't mean I have to give one group a pass because they're not Democrats. The Democrats are virtually all corrupt. Every one of them is a corrupt socialist, without exception. I don't know of a single exception. With Republicans, there's probably, I don't know, a good percentage of them who are honest men. But a lot of them are louts, total louts and criminals. Just like their Democrat colleagues, which is why nothing changes in Washington. Which is a good thing, actually. It's actually a good thing because more or less the restaurants are still full. People are going away for vacation. Most of us could go around without guns in our hand. And so, you see, we almost had an insurrection in America. Don't tell me it's Iowa again. I can't take it. First of all, I never met anyone from Iowa. That's number one. How do they know what's going to... Why do I care what a bunch of fat farmers in Iowa think about the election? How did this happen? This goes back to the 18th century when Iowa was important. I don't understand how they get away with this. Hundreds of years later, they're telling us that a few obese farmers in a diner in Iowa... You ever see those people? They're going to tell me who's going to be the next president, and if they can it, what does that tell you about the election? If a few fat farmers in Iowa can predict who's going to be the next president, what does that tell you about the government you have? Everything.
Savage.
I went out onto a mountain this morning. I normally bicycle in the morning, not early, late in the morning, after I've done all my emails and had the breakfast and calculated how much cholesterol versus how much fish oil versus how much vitamin E versus how many milligrams of this and milligrams of that. Before I titrated my body ready for another day on the slopes of America, then I go out in a bike ride. But I didn't want to ride today. I'm bored out of my mind. So I hiked up a mountain in the San Francisco Bay Area because it's eerily like a very, very spring day here. There's no rain. There's a terrible drought. People are enjoying the weather naturally, and myself included. And so I go up to an eerily quiet mountain in the Bay Area and hike by myself. And I look at the rocks, and I try to say to myself, Michael, you're a trained scientist. You're in the media, which is a pretty low-life job to begin with. You try to elevate the dialogue to a certain extent in what you do. You don't succeed, obviously, because the people only want to hear the mud. They don't want to hear about anything above the layer at the bottom of the ocean. They want to lay with the crustaceans, because apparently the politicians today are like crustaceans. Zero leadership. And I look at this and I realize that the rocks I'm looking at on top of this mountain, these bluish rocks, were a result of a cataclysm that began about 165 million years ago. And they were thrown up into the air, onto the surface of the earth at that time, onto the top of this mountain. You say, well, wait, now you're getting off the track. Now you're talking about serpentine rocks on the top of a mountain. What does that have to do with Newt Gingrich and the election and Obama the communist? Well, I don't know what it has to do with it. I mean, you know, you ask yourself, if you're in this business, try to put some perspective on this. You have one gang of interests versus another gang of interests. They're called Democrat gang, Republican gang. You have two competing philosophies as to how the economy should be run. One gang says, take from everybody who earns and gives it to the non-earners. Tax those who work and don't tax those who earn very little. The other people say, wait a minute, that's not fair. But fundamentally, there's no difference in them socially. So now we have Newt Gingrich, who claims to be a conservative, claiming that a fiscal conservative candidate is bad. So what does he want? The answer is, if you're stupid enough to not understand this, I can't help you. That's why today I had to pull myself out of all of this and go up to the serpentine-rich areas of this mountain and look at some of the mountaintop. And as I'm looking at the rocks, I got to tell you, it's related to the economy in a way. I know I'm a little, you know, discursive here, but I look at the big rocks on the top of this mountain, and they're made up of magnesium, nickel, cobalt, chromium, etc. And I think back to the Civil War that almost bankrupted America, and I realize that here in California, in the neighboring state of Nevada, we had, which was once the largest silver stores, I think, discovered at the time, the Comstock Lode. And do you know that the Comstock Lode of silver was used to pay off the Civil War debt? Now, think of what I just said to you. The war cost a great deal of money. The war nearly bankrupted America. But in those days, the politicians couldn't just print money. The money was tied to silver and gold. And so they used the silver, the minerals, in other words, in the earth of Nevada, the natural resources of Nevada, to pay off the war debt. Now, speed the clock forward. We have the Iraq War, which cost this country about $3 trillion, according to some estimates. Those ungrateful SOBs in Iraq have not sent us so much as a barrel of oil because we haven't taken it, nor have we demanded it. You know what I feel about that. We should have taken the oil to pay off the war debt at the very least. But the war debt was never paid off, and that was the beginning of our bankruptcy. Now, you can blame the welfare state all you want, and believe me, there's plenty of blame for the welfare state in terms of our bankrupt state. But the fact of the matter is, it was the war in Iraq that probably began the road that we will never come back from. We have not yet paid off the Iraq war debt. We're not paying off the Afghanistan war debt. Where in the world do you expect this to come from? I ask myself every day, when in fact they're not paying off the debt. What should we talk about? Serpentine rocks? Would you like me to talk about hiking on the mountain today? Serpentine rocks? And the fact that within 110 years, everyone listening to the show will be dead? Do you realize we all share something in common? We're all traversing through the universe at the same time. And that within 110 or so years, everyone listening to this program, in fact, everyone on the planet, whether they were just born or they're 95 years old, will be off this planet. You'll be gone. And you'll just be part of the compost, if at all. And that when you look at a mountain like this and you realize that it was created about 165 million years ago, you know, you realize that life unto itself is a miracle. Our place on this earth is miraculous. It's only for a short dance in the sun that we're here to begin with. How much can I talk about what these empty suits from television have to say about reality? How much can we take of this? What country are we living in that we permit this to go on?
Savage.
I'm going to lighten things up a little bit because it gets too hot. We got to slow her down. We'll come back to very strong politics in a minute. Many people would like me to read from Abuse of Power, but let me see if I can find... Here, I'm going to read your piece, Tel Aviv, Israel. My character, Jack Hatfield... Wait a minute. I don't know if I can give you... Yeah, all right, I'll read you this paragraph. Tel Aviv, Israel, way into the book, in the middle of it. Welcome to the city that never sleeps, the Reb said as they exited the highway. Traffic was light on the new express lane into Tel Aviv, and the drive-in from Ben-Gurion International Airport had taken them only 20 minutes. Rabbi Mel Nirschem had come in from San Francisco on an earlier flight to make the appropriate arrangements for Jack's arrival. Jack had known Nirschem for many years now. They'd met through a mutual acquaintance, Bill Hicks, a private detective. Hicks and Hatfield frequented the same restaurant, a place on Columbus, the North Beach restaurant, where they both liked to eat at the bar as they watched the crowd coming and going while they talked what they called the unholy trinity, sports and politics and religion. The city's ruling elite still ate there. Pelosi, Brown, the former mayor, all the known and hidden power brokers. One night, Hatfield brought up his disenchantment with the Catholic Church, echoing his father's own discontent, and complained that it had lost its edge and become too pacifist. No fire, no brimstone. If you're looking for fire and brimstone, Hicks said, you should check out my old friend, Rabbi Nirschem, toughest Jew I know. The more he heard about this rebellious Rebbe, hence the Reb, the more curious Jack got. Although he'd been raised Catholic, he'd always been attracted to his mother's history and culture. So a few days later, he set up a meet with Nirschem, discovered a kindred soul, and the two became instant friends. And when the Reb found out Hatfield had Jewish blood, he insisted Jack join him and his friends on Friday nights for prayer, vodka, and a home-cooked meal, an invitation Jack had accepted more than once. This is from Abuse of Power, page 169. Hicks had been right. Nirschem was a tough old Jew. The product of an Orthodox day school, the Reb had fallen out of love with Judaism in his late teens, and much to his parents' dismay, decided to rebel. He was a hippie in the 60s. Later a boxer. Then in his middle years, he rediscovered his roots with a fierce passion and spent 5 years studying Jewish law at a rabbinical seminary in New York. This was followed by a year in Israel before returning to San Francisco as an ordained rabbi. The Reb was a black hat, a Chabad Lubavitch Hasid, who often spent weeks at a time in Tel Aviv. Jack himself hadn't been here in years. The first thing he noticed now was how much the place had grown. Comparisons to New York were no longer as laughable as they'd once been. Tel Aviv was a thriving metropolis perched on the edge of the Mediterranean. Everything about it screamed big city. So where are we headed, he asked the rabbi as they took the exit. First, we do something about those clothes. Jack was wearing jeans and a suede leather jacket. You want to blend in with us? You'll have to look the part. Hatfield had once asked him why Hasidic Jews always wore dark clothing, and Nirschem explained they were more concerned with what was on the inside rather than what was fashionable.
In fact, these Hasids wore 19th century Polish business garb. They were stuck in a fashion time warp. I'm not so sure about blending in, Jack said. If I dressed like you, I'd probably look more like Johnny Cash than Menachem Schneerson. The rabbi smiled. Bring a guitar, you'll get all the girls. Anyway, I won't read you anymore because it starts to give away too much of the plot. It's, some of the lines are very funny, by the way. Let's see. All right, I'll read you a little bit more because it's fun. Page 171. I'm trying to skip plot elements so that you go out and you read the book yourself. Let's see. It hadn't taken much convincing to get the rabbi involved in Jack's plight. The Reb was rumored to have connections to both Mossad and the Israeli mafia. And while he wasn't a violent man, he'd never shied from a good fight. He was also known to quote Rabbi Meir Kahane, the founder of the Radical Jewish Defense League, who was assassinated in a Manhattan hotel room in 1990 by persons unknown. Every Jew, a 22, the Reb had said more than once. A staunch proponent of the Second Amendment, the Reb had always supported a well-armed citizenry, which he believed was the only way to keep another Castro or Stalin or Hitler or Chavez from rising in America. The one thing that stops an evil government from seizing total power, he once told Jack, is fear of millions of armed citizens. The Brits learned that lesson a couple of hundred years ago. Yet despite his tough talk, the Reb was genuinely a kind and friendly man. He acted as a missionary to fallen Jews he met in the streets of San Francisco, trying to bring them back to God. He'd saved many a drugged-out soul over the years, and they loved him for throwing them a spiritual life preserver when they were drowning. In some ways, Jack was in need of a life preserver himself, and once he told his story, the Reb was all too happy to help. Michael Savage, Abuse of Power, the finest novel written about San Francisco since Jack London, in my opinion. And it's in my humble opinion. I wouldn't say it if I actually didn't believe it. I mean, you think it's tongue-in-cheek? You're mistaken. My descriptions of San Francisco and of the Bay and of voting have never been surpassed by anybody that I know of, or I wouldn't have written the book. Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
It is a mad, 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 mad world, and I fear that we could be heading towards a national nervous breakdown. You know, it's happened to other countries. But when you have a King Ludwig in the White House, as we have, who has bankrupted the Treasury, yes, he inherited a $1 trillion deficit. That is true, but he turned it into a $4 trillion deficit. There's no arguing with the facts, and the fact is the man is a fiscal communist who prints money in order to buy votes. There's no other explanation for it. He pays back the cronies who put him in office, fake loans, in my opinion, to these solar companies that are going out of business as fast as you can say solar energy or as fast as you can say Neptune. And people can't keep up with the number of scandals that come and go from the Obama administration. And the myths that keep flying out of the White House, the myths about the jobs and he saved the world and the economy's better. Well, the economy is slightly better, by the way. If you look around, I mean, you don't have to be a genius to see that. But I don't know what the reasons are for the betterment of the economy. Personally, I think it's people are just spending money. The restaurants are full wherever you go. People are buying cars again. The housing market is still extremely sluggish because it was a false bubble to begin with. How many times can you flip a house and think that you're Donald Trump? I mean, how many idiots? Condo, they bought for $192 and they sold for $212, and they thought they're ready on the road to Donald Trump. They'll flip this house, put in the, everywhere you went, marble and this, and the marble. Everywhere there's someone from Mexico was cutting a piece of marble in a driveway. Wherever you turned, there was a marble cutter. I never saw anything like it, the tile and the marble. I never saw anything like it in my life. Then it all came to a grinding halt. All the saws were sitting unsinging in the driveways, thank God for me.
But, you know, so people are not as afraid to their spending. But where's the money coming from? That's what I'd like to know. The military cutting to the bone. NASA destroyed. Space flights destroyed. You say it doesn't matter. Well, does it matter? Then if it doesn't matter, why is China developing space weaponry? If it doesn't matter, why is China racing as fast as they can to develop as advanced space technology as they can? If it doesn't matter, why is, and he wants to cut our nuclear arsenal by another 80%. So you say, well, what do we need all those nukes for? We only need 200 to 300. Then why is China upgrading their nuclear stockpile? Why is Russia upgrading their nuclear stockpile while he is diminishing it? These are amazing points. And you haven't heard one of these points from any of the sad sacks on the Republican side. Not one. So we the people sit here saying, how much more can we take of this? How much more? You had the easiest slam dunk victory in history. And here they came along and they let, look, it was Newt Gingrich who destroyed the Republican Party. But I don't think it was he alone. I think he was in cahoots with the RNC to do it. I've had this terrible feeling in my gut that it was 8 years Dems, 8 years Repub, and then it was going to be 8 years Dem, no matter what he did, no matter who it was in power, that the power structure can't afford to switch management every 4 years. It's too hard to reestablish lobbyists and get the lines running through again, the money lines. So it's easier to let the other party have it for 8 years because you got all the other, you know what I'm saying? That's how it works. At least that was one of my bad moments. I saw it that way. Yeah, you know, it's possible, isn't it? Is it not possible that they're throwing the election? Tell me the truth. I don't know. They disappeared. All of the right wing guys who I really respected, the really good conservative senators, they like stopped talking. You don't hear from them anymore. Could you name one person who could be picked up seriously who could win? Don't come up with a name like Rush Limbaugh, please. And tell me, you know, Sean Hannity could win. That's what I want to hear next. Bill O'Reilly should run for the presidency. They're going to get like lunatic answers like that. Mike, you should run. We got your back. We light candles for you. We got your back, Mike. Go, Mike, go. We got your back, Mike. We're with you. Yeah, banned in England. You know who had my back? The donors to my fund. That's it. Still languishing. I can't go to England. I want to get my teeth done. I can't go there. I want to eat their great cuisine. I can't get into England to experience the great socialist cuisine of England. But if it doesn't, you know, would I go there? Would I really go if my name is lifted? I don't know. After what they did to me, I don't want to ever go there. I like the architecture. I like the Regency architecture the most. I like the period architecture, but I really don't want to go there to see Islamabad in London. To be frank with you, I could do without women in burqas as England. To me, England was always, you know, mutton pie, Winston Churchill, rosy cheeks, bulldogs, jaguars. You know, somehow it wasn't full body coverings from Islamabad and hate eyes behind the veils. You know what I mean? I don't really need to go there now. Go see another curry shop. I can go to San Francisco. Get me started with this tiger shrimp. Next thing will be a food discussion. All roads lead back to the shrimp. That's all I can tell you. Every road leads right back to the same thing. And nature yawns. Nature yawns at all of this. The landforms, they just sit here. They look at us like little ants crawling around. The graveyards are filled, and they keep filling up generation after generation the way of all flesh. The landforms, the landforms, the landforms, he said. The graveyards, the graveyards, the graveyards, they fill, he said. And so what does he agonize and why does he eat his guts out? He asked. I don't know. Why do I? Why am I sitting here doing this with my back to a wall worrying about all of this? It's liable to blow up in our face. The nation is liable to have it. It's going to go there. I believe that the Occupy movement are the advanced troops of the Obama thugs. He unleashed them on America. In fact, everyone has the sound bites of him supporting them. Pelosi supported them. Hillary supported them. And you see, again, if you had a viable alternative party, the Republicans, if they were viable, they'd be showing playing the speeches of Obama supporting the Occupy thugs, right? And then they would show the Occupy thugs and what they're doing, throwing urine bags at police, things like that. And they'd say he supported the Occupy thugs. He unleashed them. They're his private army. He's a dangerous man. He's not fit for office. You don't see any of this. You got to ask yourself, why? Why is the RNC avoiding the obvious? Because they don't really want to win. It's nothing to do with the party nor the country, because they know that they're committing harikari just by the things they're saying.
Savage.
Las Vegas, Larry, you're on the Savage Nation.
Hi, Dr. Savage, afternoon. I just want to tell you, I believe my wife divorced me because I've listened to your show too much. Every time I listened to it after work, she would rush over and turn that radio off and yell at me. I'd have to go in the garage and listen to your show.
Larry, let me ask you, did you have a good marriage prior to listening to my show?
No, when the radio was off, everything was fine.
No, but I mean prior to having found my show to listen to. In other words, was your marriage stable separate from the show, or was this an excuse?
Found your show almost the same time we got married, and back just a month before 9/11, and that just led to it. I think that was a part of the reason that she divorced me, because we couldn't agree on nothing. She told me I was a doomsday person listening to your show.
Oh, she didn't want to hear the bad news, in other words. She thinks I'm making it all up.
Oh, she thought you were crazy.
Yeah, I'm crazy. That's right. I'm crazy.
You thought I was crazy, right. And I can't find your book anywhere in the local supermarkets when I shop, even though they have
books. Well, it's in Barnes & Noble, Target, and all the bookstores in Las Vegas. But I would send you two copies, but you're only one now, Larry, so I'm going to send you one copy of Abuse of Power. Would you say it's worth worth it to you, Larry? Are you still on, Larry?
Yes, sir.
Larry, is it worth losing your wife over me?
Yes, sir. I'm much happier now. I listen to your show without any interruptions.
Well, what did she object to? She just didn't like what I was saying or how I said it, or both?
She would just flat out rush over and turn the radio off in anger. She would get angry.
But she wouldn't discuss any of the statements with you.
She wouldn't want to discuss anything with me. I would say...
Well, what about okay, let's be real about it. Aside from political commentary I would make, forget me, would she have discussions with you about anything?
No, we had pretty poor communication, to be honest.
All right, so she was basically a terroristic wife.
I agree.
And she was using me as an excuse to beat you up.
Oh,
the one thing that excited your mind, she hated the most because she couldn't reach you the way I did.
That's right, and I listened to you... I go nuts if my radio's off. I have to turn it on every time. I have to listen to you every single day or I go crazy. I mean, you're like an uncle and a father that never spoke to me.
Well, Larry, I would laugh if I said I didn't hear this many times. I have a unique role in America, and I really have to tell you, I know how attached the audience is to me, and how you have to understand it's a two-way street, though, Larry. I'm very attached to my audience. So it's not like I'm sitting here like some demigod throwing down lightning bolts. I'm communicating with my audience of like-minded individuals. The big problem for America today is that there's very little emotion and passion coming from the candidates themselves. Look at the Republican field. Is there anyone who reaches you the way I do? No. No. They're not talking to you. They're talking at you. They're giving you homilies. They're giving you garbage. You know that they're not going to do anything that they say they're going to do.
Savage.
I'm going down to Louisiana. Honey, behind.
Another 4 years of Obama. Free guitar strings for everyone.
I'm going down to Nevada.
Going to Nevada to do some gambling. Get me a pretty girl there now. I got the travel passes from Obama. I'm going to get me one them girl Nevada. Oh, Louisiana. Sorry. Louisiana. I thought he said Nevada. What's down in Louisiana? That's where the refinery is that Obama doesn't want to send the oil to. You know, I was talking about the dead man's pants, so I actually wore pants that were hand-me-downs. Actually, they were not hand-me-downs. They were from Stiff's. I told you my father used to buy estates, so to speak, estates of the poor people. You go in and buy the whole household goods. The widow wanted to get rid of the old man's junk, you know, so including the clothing. And he'd bring home the clothing, and I knew it was a killer for me. Every time he'd bring home a good pair of pants, I knew it was coming. He'd say, take a look at this fabric. I dreaded the moment when he'd say, take a look at this fabric. And he would roll out the pants on his arm like a clothing salesman. He would say, this is some fabric. We're not going to throw this out. The next thing I knew, 2 days later, they were shortened at the knee like Abbott and Costello, not taken in the behind. And there I was. I swear there's a picture of me, but these are such shabby pants. I was going to ask you a question on the show, which, by the way, Jerry Lewis celebrated his 86th birthday. Always been one of my... I love the guy. I love everything he's ever done since I've been a little kid. I can't believe he's 86. He survived that with the, you know, when he had the steroids and he's puffed. Remember that? He survived that. He had his party in the Friars Club. I'm not having in the Friars Club. Obviously, anyway, so he was going to ask poverty. I was going to talk about. There is no poverty in America. You realize that. What is poverty? You know what poor is? Poor is not America today. Poor is hunger. I've tried to define what poverty is. First of all, you know there's no hunger in America. Between food stamps and government cheese, there is no hunger in America. It's a complete lie of the liberals. Poverty today is more or less gone in America. There are poor people, but most poor people live better than most middle class, lower middle class people did 100 years ago, 80 years ago, 70 years ago.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
We're playing Hawaiian music because, first of all, I'd like to be there right now, truthfully. But I'm going to wait it out. Great place. It's a great place. Great. I lived there for a number of years, you know. You know what it's like for a kid from New York to go, like, to wind up in Hawaii? I'd never been in a place like that. It was unbelievable. It was like walking into, a heaven itself. So anyway, to make a long story short, we're talking about a turn it off now, a long time ago. You know, when you land in heaven, you think you can do anything. And you have hubris. Hubris is a sense of confidence that only children and the mad have and can understand. But when a grown-up has hubris, it becomes very dangerous. And in my case, that was true. So you get to the islands, and it's a magical time. You never saw sunsets like this. They can break your heart. When you see plumeria blossoms lying on the, you know, I used to bicycle up to the university. I would see plumeria blossoms lying on the sidewalk. I would stop the bicycle and pick up the plumeria blossoms and look at them and smell them. And I'd never seen anything like this. Sure, I had seen rose petals on the fence in the Bronx when I was a little kid. They were soft and beautiful, but this was something unique. The scent was unlike anything I had ever experienced. And so you see these sunsets and these sunrises and all of these things that you have never seen, and birds in the jungles in the back of the rainforest that you never saw or heard before. And you start to get tuned into your own body in a way you've never been tuned in. If you've never lived in the tropics and it's the first time, and you start shedding clothing and shoes and leather and you put it all away, and now you're in flip-flops, and then you're in shorts, and all of a sudden at night the breeze comes through your sleeves, and you start to become alive in a new way, and you go in the warm water. So you start to feel like the original man, and you buy a sailboat. It's the first thing you do. And so I bought a sloop-rigged boat. She was not catch-rigged, I was mistaken. I remember now. Terangi was a sloop-rigged sailing vessel about 22 feet long, and it was made of white oak primarily, and had been built in Oregon and sailed out by somebody else to Hawaii. I bought it for nothing, you know, next to nothing. She was in perfect shape and no engine, as I said. So I buy this boat. I put it into the Alawai Yacht Harbor, and that's where I kept it. And, you know, most people who own boats mainly use them to drink on and hang out, and it's as good a thing to do as any. But I was foolish enough to actually want to sail the boat, even though I knew nothing about sailing. And I took it out without an engine. I knew it was pretty easy to get out because the wind was prevailing out of the yacht harbor. And I said, wow, this is great. And so I, you know, with a few friends, I was on a boat alone. They just cast me off, released the lines, pushed me backwards, And then there we go, down the Alawai Channel, out into the channel and out into the ocean. I was zipping along with the sail out, and I was zipping along out onto sea, and there I was. I said, this is super. I'm really enjoying myself. Then I realized I didn't know how to get back. I said, how do I turn this thing around if the wind is blowing out? Well, I didn't know how. And I said, well, I better figure this out, because if this keeps up for a while, I'll soon be out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and there'll be no way back at all. I had no flares, no radio, no engine. All I had was confidence that was bordering on the insane. So the first thing I did was I resorted to common sense, and I dropped the sails, because that, of course, would cut the motion of the boat. I dropped the sails, and using the tiller, I turned the boat around, you know, flip-flop, flip-flop, until I got the boat pointing back towards the land. And then I figured if the wind is blowing against me, there must be a way to go into a prevailing wind and still move against it. I've seen other people do it. And little by little, and lo and behold, I was able to, luckily, I don't know whether it was current or God's hand itself pushed me back into the harbor, but I learned quickly that sailing is not for the amateur. That's all there was to it. So those days are over. But she was my first boat. I don't have a life ring from Tarangi because I didn't even have a life ring. I don't even think I had a life preserver. You know, those were the age. That was an age when people had total, like, madness about what they could do and accomplish in the late 60s. But now I drive a power boat, and it has all sorts of safety equipment on it. Sure, not enough as I should have. But I like power boats a lot better because they're easier to get out. I can get this thing out of the way. It's 45 feet, twin diesels, 19 tons, unladen with fuel and water, and I can go out on it alone and come back on it alone in almost any wind. And that's the good part. You can get out in 12, 15 minutes, and there it is. It's just you and the birds and the water and the land, and that's it. And that's what I go out for now, is just to look at the water and look at the birds and look at the landforms, mainly, and the seals I like. And I can name every bird on the bay. More or less, I know every bird on the bay as a species. Not by name, not like, how you doing, howdy? I don't mean that. Species-wise, I've come to understand that every animal has a personality. Isn't this strange? It's not that the PETA folks are correct. I still eat animals. But they all have a personality when you get to know them. And they all want to live. Dad taught me that everything wants to live. That's how he taught me to respect human life. He said, you'll notice that a cat wants to live, a dog wants to live, a rat wants to live, a mouse wants to live, a bird wants to live. And he had learned that when he had accidentally shot a bird. As a kid, remember, this is odd to a country boy listening to the show. It sounds very weak. But remember, I'm a New York City boy. And to us, it's a different experience than it is to you guys. I respect your ability to hunt for your food. But every animal actually has a personality when you get to know that animal. They're all different. Just as we're all different, every human is unique and like a snowflake. Well, guess what? So are animals. They're all unique. It's amazing when you come to understand that.
Savage.
Did I ever tell you about One-Armed Frank? You haven't heard the One-Armed Frank story. Do I have a moment? My father, I told you, was an antique dealer. May he rest in peace. So we would come home from... Well, he had a guy who came in with one arm. I don't know how the guy became one arm. But he, you know, you didn't know a lot of people with one arms in those days. Even today, they have a... I guess you don't know one-armed people today. They have a fake arm. But he had the arm sewed up, you know, in a suit. So, all right, you accept him. His name, though, was One-Armed Frank. Because nobody hid reality in those days. Today it's like, oh, yeah, he's normal. He's just like a... In those days, it was One-Armed Frank. Today it's like, oh, he's better than normal, man. He's special. Like, if you have one arm, you're better than a guy with two arms today. You know what I mean? If you have no arms and no legs, you're Superman in the politically correct world of today. But in those days, if you were missing an arm, that's what you would name, One-Armed Frank. Whatever your anomaly was, that was your name. It made it easier for the average person to remember everybody. So One-Armed Frank was a very sweet guy, but a breath on him. Now, I want to tell you, there are bad breaths, then there are very bad breaths, then there are medicinal problems. This had to be solved with a medicine that hasn't been invented yet. It was wintertime, and once in a while, my old man would drive One-Armed Frank home, and I'd get stuck in the back, and One-Armed Frank would get shotgun. Now, I want to tell you something. It could be -4 degrees in New York. You had to ride with all the windows open. Did you ever have a person like this, Greg? I'm serious, where it's medicinally like a medical problem, where he says anything and the car fills with a noxious fume, where you don't know what to do. You know, are we going past the Trons Meat Factory? No, we're not Williamsburg.
Did we run over a small furry creature that got caught in the muffler and shot up through the floorboard? Did I step on something on the way? No, it's Frank talking.
Savage.
Someone once said this to me, a professor back in 1970. He said, you know, you're the only person I've ever met. He said, it's astonishing that you can function. He says, you have no barrier between your conscious and your subconscious. You actually function with both at once. So I said, and so what's wrong with that? In other words, I've plumbed my depth sufficiently through self-analysis to know who I am, and I'm not ashamed of it. What do I got to hide? I'm not like most people. I mean, well, what's there to hide? When everything I see isn't so pretty. But that's life, you know. Out of the muck, a lotus will grow. We all come from the muck, and we all go back to the muck. We come from the muck. We go back to the muck. What more do you need to know? None of us are demigods. None of us are God. Once you understand that we arise from a smelly ether called the swamp of life, and that is what we go back to, the rest is very easy. Then you stop worrying about if you have an extra little flab on your stomach and a gray hair and a mole on your face. And you suddenly accept yourself for what you are. Then you can wear an undershirt and look at yourself in the mirror and say, that's it, thank God I'm alive. And I got two legs and two arms and two lungs and a beating heart. What more do I need? I'm going to look like a bicycle rider who takes cocaine? Oh, God, what am I talking about? Why are you listening to me? I'm going up and down the scale here. I'm playing the scales for you on the Savage Nation. No, I'm a little upset because I opened a letter just now, a personal letter. I shouldn't have done it during the show. I got all my mail and I opened one from a relative. It's a shocker. It's a picture of my late father from a year before he died. Photo of daddy enclosed. Your mother kept it in her bag till she did. No, I never saw this picture. He looked healthy. He shouldn't have died this young. I'm older than he was, and he died. It's eerie. Yeah, I thank God Oscar the cat is in here. He's liable to curl up next to me, and it will be all be all over. He's in better shape than I am. Are you kidding me? And he died anyway? Not a gray hair on his head. And thin? I put on weight. I got gray hair, and I'm still kicking. Go figure it out. You know how many guys died in their 30s that I knew who were runners? Huffing and puffing with watches, and they'd vitamin every minute. They looked at their watch. They wouldn't touch this, and they ate perfect. They dropped dead like flies. I don't say don't exercise, but no man is made to run like an Ethiopian bee picker day and night. You're not living in Ethiopia at 12,000 feet. That's why they win these races everywhere. That's they run at high altitudes. You don't. Every year there's a few blowouts here with the San Francisco, what do they call it? Marathon, the marathon. Every year they got someone dropping dead before the finish line. If you want to run, go run. Enjoy yourself. This too shall pass. This I have a whole different theory of exercise at a certain point in your life. Now, remember, I wrote the book on nutrition, and I also exercise moderately, but the key word is moderately. This excessive, like you're on a treadmill, heart attackville. It's worse than sitting in front of a television and eating Doritos. And I'm telling you, no human being has made the... You ever see old men running like that? It's insanity, total insanity. Show me in nature where a man runs like that after the age of 40, unless he's being chased by a predator who wants to burn his house down. Nobody runs like that if they don't have to. What did the great American writer say, Mark Twain? He said, I get all my exercise going to the funerals of my more athletic friends. It was funny. It worked for him. For him, it worked. I'm sure if he ran, he would have been dead at 30. I'll never forget when I stopped running the day. Are you interested in any of this? Or do you want to talk about home invasion? I'm in a sweat from the whole story already. I ate nuts during the break. I got this picture. Now I'm having palpitations. I think I'll have a pizza for dinner tonight and beer. Nah, I think tonight I'm going to drive into the city. I'm not in the city. I'm not in San Francisco now. I'm out in the suburban location, one of my Arafatian houses. I have many locations. I don't know where I'm going to be the next night. That way, if anyone, they don't know where I'm going to, because I don't know where I'm going to broadcast from or where I'm going to sleep. I have several locations. I have to. That's what the liberals are today. I have to watch out for them because they're all psychopaths. Every last one of them belongs in a mental hospital. Or let's say, or in a straitjacket. That's all. Look how they treat. Forget it. I don't want to go into bashing liberals. It's been done too often. And I did it better than anybody. Oh, let's move on. Now you see, I'm what do you call it when you talk and talk and he looked good. Look at this. I can't get it out of my head. I shouldn't have looked at these pictures. He was, God bless him. A lot of good it did him. The wife, black hair, thin, kept in shape and dead. And what about Winston Churchill? He sat in the bathtub drinking brandy and smoking cigars. It hurt him. Could you picture him running around, let's say, England during World War II, saying, I got to do a stress break now? Our president, all our NBA-like leaders, they all run, they're in perfect shape, and they can't think. He sat with a brandy and a cigar in a bathtub. He was able to lead Britain through the darkest days of World War II. How is that? How is that possible? Stop with the sobriety, have a drink, and sit in a bathtub with a cigar. Maybe you can save the country. You'll have some insights. Like, take the handcuffs off the men, number one, and tell the liberals to go to hell, number two. That might save America. KNEW, San Fran. What? Someone from England sent me a new one. I use San Francisco, San Francisco. San Fran. She called us something else. A friend from somewhere. A long email. San Fran. I can't remember why I bring it up. Going back to the Lower East Side of New York. Dad owns a small antiques mart. Little old Michael's cleaning bronzes in the back, and there's Louis the Bum from the Bowery, who in those days, he was a drunk. He wasn't a bum. He worked. Dad would have him in on the weekends, and he'd clean the bronzes and whatever he did down there. I loved Louis. Louis was a great guy. But now you got to understand, this guy was a stoned alcoholic of the old school. Skinny like a rail. White guy, skinny like a rail, smoked like unfiltered cigarettes. But one of the nicest guys on earth. He wears the rubber apron. He's cleaning downstairs, does the bronzes. Then, of course, I took over because Dad wanted cheap child labor, and where else are you going to get it from his son, you know? So I'm doing the thing. So I got to know Louis over the years, and he taught me various things. Like once we had Louis over to the house. I'll never forget it. I was so proud that my father took this guy who I liked all the way out to Queens and invited him to dinner. I don't know what came over. Maybe it was Thanksgiving or whatever. And Louis had dinner with us at the table, and the guy was surprisingly erudite, and he knew things. And like after dinner, we did games, and Louis the drunk showed me how to bend nails. He showed me mind over matter. He took a nail and he showed me that if you put your fingers, blah, 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 and put your mind on it and keep up the pressure, the nail would bend. I was shocked because I was a skinny kid with little hands, and I bent the nail. And he taught me mind over matter, but it was all molecular because you put the heat and the pressure, blah, 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 eventually that nail is going to bend. But I learned in life it's the same thing. It's all willpower, okay? Now there's another element to the story. So Louis is this kind of guy, interesting, but an alcoholic, and this and that. Years go by. He lives alone in Williamsburg. In those days, Williamsburg was like a slum, zero, you know, oilcloth city, leftover apartments from the last century. No one wanted to be there but the poor. So he lives there alone. He's very lonely. He gets a monkey. He wants a monkey. Now, out of the world, nobody in those days had a monkey. Dogs, yes. Cats, yes. No. Who had a monkey in those days? Louis gets a monkey. But Louis don't just get a spider monkey, one of the skinny little monkeys. Louis gets a woolly monkey. Now, woolly monkeys are already strong. They got a chest on them. They got strong hands. And Louis's in love with this monkey. For a couple of months, they're inseparable. Wherever he goes, there's the monkey. And the monkey's on his shoulder and where he's cleaning and he's happy. Now, Louis was the kind of guy that if he went to a bar in the Lower East Side, I remember the name to this day, named Hamel and Corn. Whatever money he made for my father, he'd take 2 minutes later, he'd be in the bar, and he'd throw money in a jukebox, and he would whistle and sing, and he'd buy everyone drinks till he was broke. He'd stumble out in the street. He would get hit by a car, sleep on a bar. He didn't care. Live for the booze, and that was it, but he had a heart of gold. So Louis gets the monkey, finally has someone to fill his empty nights, and as I say, they were inseparable. Well, as time went on, we get a call. Louis in the hospital. He's dying. What? The monkey went crazy in his apartment, attacked him, and almost ripped him to pieces. And he suffered for 6 months in the hospital. I don't know which hospital. Probably Bellevue, because that's where they all wound up. And the monkey went at him. And you don't know what a monkey's like when it goes crazy. You try to stop an enraged monkey without a weapon. He ripped his neck. He ripped his face. He ripped his arms. He ripped his leg. He ripped his crotch. He ripped his behind. Louis was ripped up pretty bad. And eventually, Louis knew that the instincts had to kick in. It was him or the monkey. And he decided it was better him than the monkey. He didn't consult a liberal book on how to deal with a crazed monkey. He just fought with it and killed it. I think that's what the bottom line is here. But the point is that even a lonely drunk needs companionship at night. In his case, he found the monkey. It was probably the right thing for him to do. So right now you could see that Louis was a pioneer in a way, in a sense that he understood that monkeys were dangerous long before they did in India when they turned him into a sacred animal. And that's the Louis and the monkey story on the Savage Nation. You got to admit it wasn't bad. It's nicely entertaining. And that's it. That's the story. The bottom line is, don't get a monkey as a pet. They're wild animals.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
I don't have a way to begin this story other than to tell you I was on my bicycle before the show in one of my moods. I go in and out of moods and grousing about. I just read that there was a Russian in New York who bought a $150 million apartment, so I started to get mad. Grousing about that, saying, I don't understand this world I'm living in. There are guys coming back from Iraq without legs and arms. And this guy has enough money to buy another $150 million apartment. Well, something's wrong with the picture here. So I said, look, I have a choice right now. I could sit here getting angry, or I get on my bicycle and take a 10-minute ride. Because I remember that many years ago, 20 years ago, I read a couple of self-help books. And one of them said that in the few minutes that you're sitting there grousing about how bad things are, you can send a letter, make a phone call, run around the block. And you know what? It helped me then, and it helps me now. So I got on the bike, and I went down to a kind of isolated area where they're building some new houses by the water, because I love to watch houses under construction. It's very optimistic to see the wood and the contractors and the this and the that. And I'm out by the point, and I'm coming back, and I see this big, black, Great Dane off a leash. Now, I happen to be afraid of black dogs. I mean, big black dogs. In fact, big white dogs. In fact, big dogs generally frighten me because I was bitten when I was young, right down to the bone, and had to be hospitalized. So I have a real respect for dogs. So I said, now, I got to be very careful as I go by this Great Dane. I don't know whose it is. If I let out anger inside of me, the dog's going to feel it. If I let out fear, the dog's going to fear it. So I said, just be cool and go. Don't go too fast. Don't go somewhere. So I go by, the dog doesn't bother me. I said, thank God for that. Then I come upon a guy who's got a truck, who's doing auto detailing. And he's a big black guy. I've seen him once in a while. Huge, I mean like a football-sized guy. And he comes out of the truck and he says to me, you're looking good. And I said, what? He says, you lose some weight? And we start to talk. I didn't know the guy. I've seen him around. But he thought he knew me. He said he knew me. Not thought, he knew me. For a number of years, he's been around this county doing cars. He's a great guy. I'm going to tell you the story now, where it goes. So one thing leads to another, and he says to me, you remind me of another radio guy I knew. He says, this guy was as smooth as can be. He could walk the ghetto, and he could walk the White House. So I said, you know, let me tell you something. I said, David, I grew up in New York City, and I had to learn how to swim with all kinds of fish.
New York City was a very big fish tank. And if you didn't learn how to swim the right way, they'd tear your fins off. And he laughed. He says, well, they wouldn't just tear your fins off. He says, they'd eat you for breakfast. And we started to talk. Now, he grew up in a black ghetto here in Marin County. There is one, and it was called Marin City. It's an interesting story unto itself. The housing was built by the magnate, Kaiser. When they were building Liberty ships in World War II, they needed to bring in workers, and they didn't bring them in from Mexico. They brought workers in from the South, and they were largely black people, and they built housing for them. And you may not know it, but many of the ship workers, you know about Rosie the Riveter, of course, but you didn't know that most of the Liberty ships were built by black people, particularly out here in Sausalito at the Kaiser shipyards. So the housing was built nearby, and it's become basically, largely a black community. And naturally, the way things have evolved in our society, and blame whoever you want, it hasn't been a picnic for the people living in there. So we were walking around, and we were just standing there talking about the dog and the this and the that. So I said, well, how did you come through that place and come out the way you are? You see, he's a pastor. In addition to running a service that, polishes cars, he happens to be a minister. His name is Pastor David Hall. And I'm going to tell you more about that in a few minutes and where this went, how that went there, and how positive this man was. And we were laughing. He says, I know people around here, very rich people. He says, their children can't play with anybody. I said, why? Well, I told him the reason your kid can't play with anyone is because you've given them everything. They got all these toys. They sit in the house and they play electronic toys. They don't know how to play with anybody. I said, isn't that a shame? And I told him that I'm a people person, that I'm not really alone, or I don't really like to be alone. But I figured if I got out on the bike, I said I'd run into somebody to talk to. And I said, sure enough, this was like hitting, the triple lottery for me in terms of the kind of person I am. It's like all four cherries came up on that big, slot machine in the sky of humanity. And this goes back to what I told you a story years ago about me and Brother Billy down in Harlem when I was a kid. But that's a whole separate story. But this is going to lead somewhere else. So we're talking and this and that. We look up a hill where they're building the houses above where he's polishing the cars. And he says, when I was a kid, he said, what we used to do for fun? I said, what? He said, we'd slide down the hill on like linoleum. I said, I can't believe it. I said, we did the same thing. I said, I lived in a tenement on a block called Longfellow Avenue in the Bronx. And above me was a hill called Bryan Avenue. Between us was a big empty woodlot that had a huge hill on it that was denuded of foliage. And we'd slide down in an oil cloth, old linoleum. And I said, well, we'd also play war. He said, how'd that work? I said, well, we'd take the garbage can covers. We'd put them in our hands, and there'd be like a gang of us. I'm talking kids 5, 6, 7 years old. No one had guns or knives. And the game was to run up the hill against the other street as they were raining ash down upon us. And like Gladiator, bounce, bounce, bing, bing. And I said, my head would get split open 100 times in these things. I always had a knack. I don't know where the ash guys, you know what the ash is from? He says, no. I said, well, in those days, I said, they had garbage that they would burn in incinerators. And the leftover of that burn was like a volcanic ash. Thank God they don't do it anymore. And I said, these kids would get the ash out of the incinerator and rain it down upon us. And you'd have to fend it off. You can go home, you can get killed. So I said, many a time I'd come home with my head bleeding, with blood running down my head. And I'd come home, my mother would faint before I got through the door. She was like a panic case. She'd go, oh, my God. And she'd fall on the floor basically screaming and yelling, I'm bleeding, and she's doing nothing. But I said, next door, I had an aunt who was like stoic, like Russian aunt. Nothing fazed this woman. She'd look at me with the sober face, get out the peroxide and bandage it up, and that was it. So he lit up. David did, and he says, when are you going to write that book? I was like, bung. I said, what? He said, when are you going to write that book? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, all those stories of your youth, he says, those are great stories. Well, we talked about so many different things. He said, I got to tell you, so I grew up on welfare. He said, my father left us when I was 5. He says, I'm one of 6 children. And he says, yeah, I ate the government cheese. He says with a big smile. He says, yeah, I grew up on the government cheese. And he says, I'd say to my mother, he says, Mom, if there's a God, why am I hungry? Now I said, oh, God, what a question. I said, kids are so smart. I said, they're brilliant. And he said, my mother told me, never be bitter, never be angry, always have faith. Now, this is the most important part of the story, is the faith that this man had. He didn't turn to bitterness. He didn't turn to anger. He didn't hate Whitey. He didn't hate America. He just did what he did, and he did it, and he did it, and he did it. And you know what? He's the richest man I've met in recent years. He is the wealthiest man I have ever met in the last 10 years. And I've met people with a lot of money. And I said, you know, you remind me of the story that Tolstoy wrote, The Kingdom of God is Within. I said, because you do emanate the goodness. He said, well, Michael, if you don't give anything back, you're going to be empty inside. And this man lives to give because he said in giving he gets love. Now, if this is not the epitome of what the Christian religion today is all about, I'd like to know what is. And so I guess the moral of the story is that the humanity in the other man can never be known until you have a contact with the other man. And, oh, I remember what a particular story before I go to the next spot got to him. I said, let me tell you a story. My dad owned a little store. And he had started on the streets of New York with a pushcart. He came from the gutter. He was an immigrant with nothing. And he never really became a wealthy man. I said, but he had a little stall inside a store. And he sold first used things. Then he sold some antique things. And he always made a living. We had a house and always food on the table. And I said, well, one day, I said, it was all white people in there. I said, never did you see anyone but white people in that market. Now, remember who I'm talking to now. I'm talking to a stranger who happens to be a black man, who happens to be, like you talk about fullback football team, huge man, and we're just looking at each other and talking. So I said, it's an all-white store. In comes a black man, well-dressed. And I said, he says to my dad, how much is that? My father says, oh, a certain amount of money. How much is that? He's pointing at different statues. All right, how much is that? How much? He says, I'll take them all. So now the man leaves, writes him a check, and my father pulls me over, and he says, I want to tell you something, Michael. He says, listen to what just happened in this store because it's a lesson you're going to learn for the rest of your life. I said, what's that? He says, never judge a man by the color of his skin. He said, you never know who the man is, you never know what the man is, and you never know what that man's all about until you have an interaction with him. So when I told it to a pastor, Pastor Hall, he says, that is a beautiful story. He says, you've got to tell that story. And so I've just told that story.
Savage.
Somebody wants to know about my dog, so I'm going to take a dog call. Jason in Albany, New York, welcome to the program.
Hey, Dr. Savage, it's an honor to talk to you. I have no idea how you do what you do every day, but I wanted to kick it down a notch, and we want to know about Teddy because you haven't talked to him about him in a while.
What can I say about my poodle? There's nothing more I can say. He's the most loyal friend I have ever had, and I've had dogs since I'm a little boy. I have never encountered a breed like this. The dog is as close to a simian as a canine can be.
It brings you back to reality. And what do you do? Do you do anything special nutritionally other than feeding him back?
I'll tell you exactly what I feed my dog. He's 7 years old, and I'm a little, you know, I'm sad already. I didn't realize time flew like this. I heard that a dog at 9 is considered a senior pet. So I've been talking to him now, like, differently. I start to say, you're soon going to be my senior pet. And I treat him a little differently now because he's almost a senior. And I look at him already. I look at the other one in the box with the ashes, the Snowy that I had for 13 years. She was amazing. I never talk about it because I wasn't on radio then, actually. I don't think. Well, I was. Snowy was a Sheltie, a small collie. Oh, did I love her. But, you know, in the blink of an eye, she went from the children being young and jumping over, like, little barriers in a park, like Lassie, with me saying, Snowy, Snowy. And there she'd run in this beautiful meadow and jump over a log to dying on a grass lawn with no light in her eye, shriveled up like a person. I mean, what are you going to do? It's the way of all flesh. And I think that's why we love our animals, because the process is speeded up with them, and we see our own self in them. It's a short dance in the sun. You know, take a deep breath because we're all on the same ship called the Earth at the same time. And no one's going to get out of this alive. And at some point, you have to say, you know, all of these people, different races, different languages, different this, different that, they all have exactly the same fears, the exact same lifespan or shelf life, one way or the other, within the norm as I do. And maybe at that point you come to realize that you don't have to kill your brother to live on this planet. I don't know what it is, but animals certainly make us a better person. I know that. Joe, in Albany, New York, you're on the Savage Nation. Joe, what's on your mind?
Hi, Mike. Back in 72, I was still married then. I'm no longer. But
I went up to a friend who was a very close friend of Jack Kerouac's up near Albany.
Oh, wow.
His name, right? And I was a little young to appreciate it, but he played for about 3 or 4 hours some tapes that I don't believe they were ever published of Jack doing this thing. And they reminded me, your brief wives and your liberal derrieres, those, I don't know what to call them, when you reveal what's inside, they reminded me of that.
You could call them esavulations if you wish.
Uh-huh.
No, that turn of phrase that I came up with, the brief wives, when the two guys are walking and they run into the old cop from San Francisco, I thought that that was amazing, and it was based upon a true conversation I had with someone. I had to work it into the novel. It was really fun to write that. Well, no, Kerouac was one of my literary heroes. There's no question. When I read On the Road, it changed my life. It absolutely changed my life. Were it not for Jack Kerouac, I'd probably be a dead dentist in New York. I would have been dead 15 years ago. I would have had a dental practice, probably, married a fat person, someone fat at birth. There's nothing against being fat, but I would have had a miserable, horrendous life as a dentist somewhere in Queens. Played the accordion in the basement probably once, and then died probably at 47 years old of heart failure.
Well, you know, I've learned a lot from listening to you, Mike, for the past 10 years. Like, I never knew what a schmo was until I finally listened to you. Also, a sewing machine.
I'm sorry. I'm still laughing at my own observation that I would have died of heart failure, because I actually used the word heart failure instead of a heart attack. Do you know why, Joe?
Why?
Why would I, as a dentist, have died of heart failure rather than a heart attack? Because the guy would have died because heart failure. He would have been a failure as a human being. And his heart just would have stopped beating. Different than a heart attack. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. Maybe I'll think about it and send you another. And you have two. You can't get another one. Can I read you at the dog show something about dogs and Napoleon, which I think you'll all enjoy hearing from my book, Abuse of Power? May I read this to you? It's a short paragraph. It's about Napoleon, so it's political. So they're at the dog show, and Jack Hatfield's talking to the senator. And one of them says, did you know that a Newfoundland once saved Napoleon Bonaparte from drowning when he fell off a ship? Napoleon didn't know how to swim, but Newfoundlands are notorious for their affinity with water. After the rescue, Napoleon himself is supposed to have said, here, gentlemen, a dog teaches us a lesson in humanity. Wickham chuckled, indeed. Loyalty, Wickham went on, that's what it's all about. You know the story about Greyfriars Bobby, don't you, Jack? Jack nodded, but the senator pointed to a waiting group of Skye Terriers and continued. Greyfriars became famous in 19th century Edinburgh after reportedly spending 14 years guarding over the grave of his owner, John Grey. A year after this loyal little dog died himself, in 1873, a statue and fountain were built in the Scottish capital to remember him. I know the story well, Jack said with a nod, from the 1961 Disney film about that angel with fur called Greyfriars Bobby. Wickham smiled warmly. Saw it as a boy, made me what I am today. I don't just mean the dog lover. I mean the concept of loyalty, dedication, no matter the inconvenience or cost. Without it, you're nothing. Jack was enjoying the conversation, but had more pressing matters on his mind. Senator, we need to talk about the hand of Allah. And I'll pause right there, because remember, this is a book about the next 9/11 being stopped by one lone American who sees it coming, and he's stopped at every turn, believe me.
This is the Savage Nation.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Indianapolis, JR, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Dr. Savage, it's a pleasure.
Thank you.
I had, when I was 16 years old, I had my first love. It was a girl that was on vacation in southern Indiana from San Antonio, Texas. We had a wonderful time. I joined the Marines and went to go see her, and I was going to ask her to marry me, and we got into an argument. And I split it up and walked out. 16 years later, we bump into each other again. And she still takes my breath away, and I just realized that she's been the basic comparison for everything, Dr. Savage.
Well, hold on. Let me ask you. You're saying you ran into her 16 years later. How long ago was that?
I just ran into her 3 days ago. I started catching up with all my old military buddies. I said, what the heck, you know? And there
she was. So you basically, blah, 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 so you ran into her again, and you still the magic is still there?
On my part, yes. I don't think on her part. It's been 16 years.
Well, wait a minute now. Did you see her physically or just on the internet?
Just on the internet. I sent her a message, and she replied on it with things that I would know. Then I replied because she asked me a question.
Is she married?
No, sir.
Well, look, women have to be more protective than men, and they are generally psychologically more protective than men. Men are much more out there like, I still like you, you know, let's get together. The woman could think you're a nut or, you know, you're a stalker, so she's being defensive and self-protective. It doesn't mean she's rejecting you. She doesn't know you, JR. She only knows the memory of you, and she doesn't even know it's really you. I wouldn't give up so fast.
Oh, I agree with you fully, Dr. Savage. That's why I'm taking this.
I would just take it very slow. I mean, I'm no, Mr. Cupid here, but I'm saying, if you really feel the same way you think about her, and you think there's a chance, and this is the girl you really want to marry or whatever, send her a couple of messages, but keep it light. Don't get too demanding and aggressive, and she'll think you're nuts. You got to say to her, you know, I've been thinking about you strangely enough, and I'm glad we ran into each other on the internet. Maybe I can tell you something more about myself. Here's what I've done. Here's who I am. Let's at least be pen pals. What's wrong with that?
None at all, sir. I have done that, and I'm just waiting on her reply. And, you know, hopefully just friends. She's the only one that I've lost track of. And
we'll let it go with that, but I'm going to tell you this. This was raised because I asked the question along these lines. And I'm sure that my book, Psychological Nudity, there's only one story you want to read, which is Love by the Sewer Plant.
That's correct, sir.
Hold on. We'll send the copy to you, and I want you to play for me now. I Only Have Eyes for You, sung by the Flamingos, and I'll tell you a story right here on the Savage Nation. Anybody get ready with I Only Have Eyes for You, blup, blup? Is that the Shabup Shabup song? Because that's the one I really want to hear. Oh, you guys are good. You are good today. Shabab, shabab.
I can't see anyone but you.
This is slow. There you go. That's the whole point. All right, now that sets the tone for this story. I write, shall I tell you the story of Love by the Sewer Plant from page 57 of Psychological Nudity? I said, remember the song I Only Have Eyes for You sung by the Flamingos? We're talking Route 42. We're talking 1956-57. We're talking a sewer plant. We're talking about Love by the Sewer Plant, First Love by the Sewer Plant. Now, this girl was so beautiful that people stopped as she went by to marvel at her. We were in a small hotel owned by a former boxer, a pugilist, a real tough guy. If he got into an argument with anyone who worked for him and they got smart, he just beat them up and threw them off the property. That type of guy. Everyone was terrified of him, an old-school New York Jewish kind of street fighter type. So he ruled his little hotel with an iron fist. Because he was tough, things ran right. Nothing ever went wrong. No one robbed cutlery. No one talked back. So anyway, I'm a kid 15 years old, and boom, it's Love by the Sewer Plant. We crossed the road to walk down to the Neversink River to make out. The water was so cold that when you waded across it, your feet turned blue. My uncle had a new Plymouth Fury, so I remember the time. This girl was so stunningly gorgeous, just really beautiful, and the theater companies would come through. They had entertainment in those little hotels and small theaters that they called casinos for a night of entertainment. Sometimes they'd have a comedian who was terrible, a juggler, or a balloon man doing cheap acts. In other words, schlocky entertainment. Nevertheless, these guys, these women, they thought they were artists. You've got to understand that. Even though they were schlocky entertainers, let's say they could paint velvet paintings, to themselves, they were still painters. In their minds, they were Van Goghs. They were theatrical and everyone else was boring. In other words, they were the artists. They understood beauty. So one day a group of these entertainers came around and just stared at this girl. They came running up to her, even though I was holding her hand as if I wasn't there. I was holding her hand and walking with her. We were just little. We were just kids. One of these artists said, "Man, I wanted you to see this girl," to one of his friends. "This is the girl I was telling you about." They looked at her like she was a specimen of biblical beauty. Where are you going to go when you're a kid and you got nowhere to go? So we took a walk down the hill. It was a long slope down to the river where there was a sewer treatment plant, which occasionally, as you well know, doesn't smell that good. Kids don't care, though. They don't care how it smells. They don't care what it's like. They can override anything, particularly when the lust hits them. So we two kids walk down the hill, cross the river, roll up the dungarees, take off our shoes. Our legs are blue, and we have a little moment of passion together. It was my first moment of passion, and not exactly on the level of a complete moment of passion. But for me, it was the first of that type. So now I'm starstruck. Coming back to my... I'm going to stop right here. I'll go to the next paragraph. There were not enough stars in the sky that night, in the black sky, the billions of stars to equal the passion that I had for the world. I thought I could literally reach out and grab a star and fly away. That's how phenomenal I felt that evening. But then, of course, as you well know, nothing like that lasts. So what I'm going to get at with this story is that it was by a sewer plant, and there's nothing more to it. Now imagine some John Coltrane, because there's no more to the story. That's all I care to tell. If I tell any more, it will become a pantomime. And I don't want to embarrass myself with a pantomime of something that was quite beautiful. This story ends quite abruptly. Good jazz ends abruptly. Guys, play a little Coltrane so they know what I'm talking about. So, my book is like a jazz poem. Many of them are like jazz pieces. Now this is starting to sound like LaBrie's Waterbeds. This is the wrong part of it. If we get it like to a better point, something a little more poignant maybe, a little jazz that moves. Otherwise they're going to go to sleep and they're going to get comatose. I'm going to wait another 30 seconds. Then either I'm going to break the record or we're going to pick a new one. Now we go. Thank you. Now you got it. Come on. Picture a hopped up drummer, man. Not someone on PCP. You know. Think 50s Jack Kerouac. Now you talk. Now you got it. Now we're there. Now we're moving. Moving. Now you hit it exactly right. That's the tone of the Savage Nation at its best. Oh, my God, that's good. My worst nightmare is, please, I don't want to get 1,000 pictures now from women around the country. Dear Dr. Savage, here I am outside my sewer plant. I don't want to get 1,000 pictures of women in various stages of undress of them outside sewer plants. Now, please, don't. I don't want it. This is, it's a story. It's just a reverie. I'm not one of those radio guys, you know what I'm saying, who's trolling. I'm not trolling. End of story. Forget it. Oh, you have to be so careful. The power of suggestion.
Savage.
The story I'm going to tell you occurred when I was a young man. First a kid and then a young man. And it was about a man who grew up as one of my father's best friends in a very poor neighborhood in New York City. They were immigrants together. Their parents came over. They came over, I think, maybe on the same boat, or they met each other in the slums of New York. And they both had a very tough life, and they worked their way up little by little, as the immigrants have to do and as they struggle in the society. And this man went into a business that took off at a certain point like a rocket. He hit a fad in a certain business, and he started to make a great deal of money, and he moved way beyond our family. While we lived in an attached house in Queens, New York, an attached brick house, he had the money to move his family to a detached house. Remember how important that distinction was in those days. It's like the Buick LeSabre as opposed to the Buick Roadmaster. Well, God forbid you, a Rockefeller, you bought a Cadillac, if you can imagine. That's how people used to grade themselves in those days by their success, you know, their status, cars and houses. I don't suppose it's much different today. It just isn't as easy to figure out in some regard, not on the road anyway. Anyway, so he moved to this detached house in Roslyn, New York. And it was a beautiful house. It had its own garden all around it. We only had a little strip of grass in the backyard and a little teeny one in the front.
And the carpet was wall to wall, and it was pink. And he was a big cigar smoker. And we go over and visit, and I had a very good time. He would gloat, you know, with the cigar and lord it over my father. And we'd leave. My father never said anything against him. But, you know, I could see in his eyes that he was in his, you know, he was a little, let's say lost that little battle at that time. You know how men are. I mean, men are competitive. Even if they love their friend, if their friend does better than them, there's a degree of envy in every human being. It's just one of the cardinal sins. As years went on, the man's business continued to thrive. And then I left home. I moved away from New York City. I went and did my thing, collecting plants, working for my graduate degrees, thousands of miles away. I was living 6,000 miles away, then 9,000 miles away in the Fiji Islands. And lo and behold, on one of my trips back to New York when I was already a father myself, I had heard that this man's business had collapsed entirely. The fad that he had rode like a wave had died. Women were no longer buying that particular product. And the man who had a chain of successful wholesale stores lost everything. He lost everything, and it was so fast that he wound up living where he started, on the Lower East Side of New York, in a poor relative's apartment with his wife and the relative's family, back where he started, in a one-room apartment. And that's where I come in. I come back from one of my trips to the Fiji Islands. I'm a young man in my, I don't know how old I must have been. I don't remember, 25, 30. I don't remember what age I was already anymore. And there he was sitting in my father's house. And I love this man. I loved him like another father. I loved all my father's friends. And you know how it is when you're a kid in a very close-knit community. You tend to love the people like they're your own. You know, we all grew up so closely together. There was never a bad word between him and my father, man. He's sitting there shrunken up in the chair in my living room where he had lost everything. And he looks up at me, still smoking a cigar, and he was shrunken in the chair. And he looks up at me in his eyes and he says, Michael, look what happened to me. Look what happened to me. And his eyes were like wandering left and right. He didn't understand what happened to him. And he said, I'd rather I have cancer than what God did to me. And lo and behold, I soon left New York. I went back to do what I did, which is collecting plants. And I heard that 2 years later, he died from one of the most rapidly invasive forms of brain cancer. Be careful what you say. God hears the truth, but waits. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Yesterday was a day that looked like I did nothing. And then at night as I went to sleep, I said, you know, this was a remarkable day. What did I do? Nothing. So it started out on the beach. I needed to get some air, and I happen to live in Northern California near San Francisco. There's a tunnel you can drive through and be at the beach in 10 minutes over the headlands of Marin County. It's an old ammunition tunnel, by the way. I don't know how many of the people who ride bicycles through there know that, but the tunnel was built as an ammo tunnel for the military in World War II. So I went out on the beach. It was a gloomy, cold day, and I walked and walked and walked. I collected flat rocks. And as I picked up these absolutely smooth flat rocks, I remembered they were once hills. And I thought of myself walking as a spirit through time, and I said, you know, doesn't that take a little of the pressure off you to realize that these rocks were once mountains and that you're just merely a man walking through time? Yeah, all right, so I got back to my real self, you know, the naturalist self. And after doing that, I went to an Indian lunch buffet. You say, well, what's remarkable about that? Well, I'll tell you what's remarkable about that. Normally I go to these things and I eat the vegetable stuff, and I try to avoid the lamb, and I eat a little of the chicken, the tandoori chicken. You know, $8.95 all you can eat. I'm not a fat guy, so I eat a plate and maybe go back for another one. I got there 1:45, and they close at 2:00. Scattered a few tables talking. That was it. Everyone was through eating. I said, could you put more lamb in there? I was in a lamb mood. I never eat it. I feel bad for the animal. And I don't like the high-fat diet. I knocked off a plate. There was nothing but bones left. I'd been sick, and I really needed the carnitine, the fat, and the B12. I was craving it.
there was grease on my hands, on my face. I took it in the back room so no one could watch me eat. I really wanted to enjoy myself. So the Indian guy who owns it, I saw on the second pass when the bones were rising in the plate, I saw the eye was going up already. You know, he saw a money loser. In the middle of the buffet, the phone rings. My hands are greasy. Now, this is a tough one. You got two greasy hands and a greasy mouth. The phone rings. I knew it was a U.S. congressman calling, and I knew I had to take the call. I had given my number out to his assistant because he said he had to call me about something, and I'll tell you more about that at another time. I'm giving you a day now, a day in the life of Michael Savage. Went home, took a nap. Then I had dinner that night. I was going to go. I wasn't going to go. Then I went. I went to dinner with two remarkable men. One is a very close friend of mine, maybe my only friend. He drives me crazy. I drive him crazy, but we love each other because we love each other. That's all there is to it. The other man is a new friend of mine. He's a producer. He's a film producer, director, and writer. We're having a pizza and a little soup and a salad. And he starts to tell me a story that I said, are you making this up? And I can't tell you the whole story right now. I'm giving you an overview. I said, well, what are you talking about? His mother and father, listen to this story, a short version. They had seven children, and then after the seven children, the mother ran off with his violin teacher and married him. I said, what? That's impossible. That can't happen. Now, how we got there was, he said, you're a great storyteller. I remember the story you're talking about, Lido Beach, Long Beach, Little House, the half man, half woman, the Bronzes. He says, I grew up there. I said, you grew up in the, yeah. He says, my stepfather was Italian. We lived in the Italian enclave out in Long Beach where it was half mafia and half this, half. So that's how he got it. He says, and then he like, by on the side, he tells me the mother ran off with the Italian violin teacher. So I said, wait a minute, tell me the rest of this. Are you making it up? And I looked it up on Google. It turns out it was true. But there was more. His mother, who died recently at age 95, was one of the first pilots, female pilots in the world. And she's on the internet. 1928, the woman was a pilot. It's unbelievable. A friend of Amelia Earhart. I said, how did your mother, a friend of Amelia Earhart, wind up marrying your father, who came to this country at age 13 and lived on the Lower East Side and sold newspapers to pay for food and lodging before he went to Columbia and then became a famous physician? How did this happen? Well, I'll tell you the story in a minute. This is now number four of the day. That night, meaning yesterday, I like to watch movies at night. I click, click, click. Most of them are junk, you know, but sometimes you hit a good one. This was on the Sundance Channel, and it's a mixed bag on Sundance, 40 Shades of Blue with Rip Torn. What's it about? Well, it's a pretty amazing story that I watched. I was captivated. You know, young Russian girl, girlfriend of older record producer in Memphis, Tennessee, comes back to America. She's his live-in girlfriend. They have a child together, but they're not married. And he's played by Rip Torn, like this garrulous, you know, kind of well-to-do guy down in the Memphis music industry. And she's this stunning, you know, Russian beauty. And they really love each other, apparently. Well, it's about her affair with his estranged son who comes to town for a party. And the way it's played out, it's a purely adult movie. It's something that many people would consider very slow. But if you like this kind of movie, it's like reading a novel, like a slow novel.
Savage.